any minute. Daniel told him that was crap and to pull himself together, but actually Daniel wasn't all that much help, seeing as he thought... He broke off and stared away down the garden, his eyes hooded. "If you hadn't pulled through when you did," he said, "I think we would have killed each other." I reached out one finger and touched the back of his hand, just for a second. "I'm sorry," I said. "I am, Rafe. I don't know how else to say it. I'm so sorry."
"Yeah," Rafe said. But the anger had drained out of his voice and he just sounded very, very tired.
"Well." "What did Daniel think?" I asked, after a moment.
"Don't ask me," Rafe said.
He threw back most of his drink with a neat flick of his wrist. "I've come to the conclusion that we're mostly better off not knowing."
"No, you said Daniel told Justin to chill out, but he wasn't much help because he thought something. What did he think?"
Rafe jiggled his glass and watched the ice cubes clink off the sides. He obviously wasn't planning to answer. But silence is the oldest cop trick in the book, and I'm even better at it than most. I leaned my chin on my arms, watched him, and waited. In the sitting room window behind his head, Abby pointed to something in the book and both she and Daniel burst out laughing, faint and clear through the glass.
"One night," Rafe said at last. He still wasn't looking at me. The moonlight slivered his profile and lay along his cheekbone, turned him into something off a worn coin. "A couple of days after, it might have been Saturday, I'm not sure, I came out here and sat on the swing seat and listened to the rain. I thought that might help me sleep for some reason, but it didn't. I heard an owl kill something, a mouse probably. It was horrible, it screamed. You could hear the second when it died." He went silent. I wondered if this was somehow the end of the story.
"Owls have to eat too," I offered.
Rafe shot me a quick, oblique glance. "Then," he said, "I don't know what time, it was just starting to get light. I heard your voice under the rain. It sounded like you were right there, leaning out."
He turned and pointed up at my dark window above us.
"You said, 'Rafe, I'm on my way home, wait up for me.' You didn't sound eerie or anything, just matter of fact, in a hurry, sort of, like that time you rang me because you'd forgotten your keys. Do you remember that?"
"Yeah," I said, "I remember." A light, cool breeze drifted across my hair and I shivered, a fast, uncontrollable jerk. I don't know if I believe in ghosts, but this story was something different, pressing like a cold knife blade against my skin. It was way too late, more than a week too late to worry about whatever damage I was doing to these four.
"I'm on my way home," Rafe said. "Wait up for me."
He stared into the bottom of his glass. I realized that he was probably fairly drunk.
"What did you do?" I asked.
He shook his head.
"Echo, I will not talk with thee," he said with a faint wry smile, "for thou art a dead thing."
The breeze had moved off down the garden, sifting the leaves and fingering delicately through the ivy. In the moonlight the grass looked soft and white as mist, like you could put your hand right through it. That shiver went over me again.
"Why?" I asked. "Didn't that tell you I was going to be okay?"
"No," Rafe said. "Actually, no, it didn't. I was sure you had just died, that second."
"Laugh if you want, but I've told you what kind of state we were all in. I spent the whole next day waiting for Mackie to appear at the door, being grave and sympathetic, and tell us the doctors had done everything they could, but blah, blah, blah. When he turned up on Monday, all smiley, and told us you'd regained consciousness, at first, I didn't believe him."
"That's what Daniel thought, isn't it?" I said. I wasn't sure how I knew this, but there wasn't a doubt in my mind.
He thought I was dead. After a moment, Rafe sighed.
Yeah, he said.
Yeah, he did. Right from the start. He thought you'd never made it to hospital.
Watch your step around that one, Frank had said.
Either Daniel was a lot smarter than I wanted to tangle with. That little exchange before I went out was starting to worry me again. Or he had had reasons of his own for thinking Lexi wasn't coming back.
Why? I demanded, doing offended. I'm not a wimp. It'd take more than one little cut to get rid of me.
I felt Rafe flinch, a tiny half-hidden twitch.
God only knows, he said.
He has some bizarro convoluted theory about the cops claiming you were alive to mess with people's heads. I can't remember the details. I didn't want to hear it, and he was being cryptic about it anyway. He shrugged. Daniel. For several reasons, I figured it was time to change the tone of this conversation.
Conspiracy theories, I said. Let's make him a tinfoil hat in case the cops start trying to scramble his brainwaves.
I had caught Rafe off guard. Before he could help it, he gave a startled snort of laughter.
He does get paranoid, doesn't he? He said. Remember when we found the gas mask? Him giving it that thoughtful look and saying, I wonder if this would be effective against the avian flu.
I had started giggling as well.
It'll look gorgeous with the tinfoil hat. He could wear them both into college.
We'll get him a biohazard suit.
Abby can needlepoint pretty patterns on it.
It wasn't all that funny, but we were both helpless with laughter, like a pair of giddy teenagers.
Oh, God, Rafe said, wiping his eyes. You know, the whole thing would probably have been hysterical if it hadn't been so god-awful. It was like one of those terrible sub-Ionesco plays that third years always write. Great piles of meat pies popping out of the woodwork and Justin dropping them everywhere, me gagging in the corner, Abby asleep in the bath like some postmodern Ophelia, Daniel surfacing to tell us what Chaucer thought of us all and then disappearing again. Your friend, Officer Krupke, showing up at the door every 10 minutes to ask what colour M&Ms you like best.
He let out a long, shaky breath, somewhere between a laugh and a sob. Without looking at me, he stretched an arm over and rumpled my hair.
We missed you, silly thing, he said, almost roughly. We don't want to lose you.
Well, I'm right here, I said. I'm going nowhere. I meant it lightly, but in that wide, dark garden, the words seemed to flutter with a life of their own, skim down the grass, and disappear in among the trees. Slowly, Rafe's face turned towards me. The glow from the sitting room was behind him, and I couldn't see his expression, only a faint white glitter of moonlight in his eyes.
No?
He asked.
No, I said. I like it here.
Rafe's silhouette moved briefly as he nodded.
Good, he said.
To my utter surprise, he reached out and ran the backs of his fingers lightly and deliberately down my cheek. The moonlight caught the tip of a smile. One of the sitting room windows shot up, and Justin's head popped out.
What are you two laughing about?
Rafe's hand dropped away.
Nothing,
we called back in unison.
If you sit out there in the cold, you'll both get earaches. Come, look at this.
They had found an old photo album somewhere. The March family. Daniel's ancestors, starting in about 1860 with vein-popping corsets and top hats and unamused expressions. I squeezed onto the sofa next to Daniel. Close. Touching. For a second, I almost flinched, till I realized the mic and the phone were on my other side. Rafe sat on the arm beside me, and Justin disappeared into the kitchen and brought out tall glasses of hot port, neatly wrapped in thick, soft napkins so we wouldn't burn our hands.
So you won't catch your death, he told me. You need to take care of yourself, running around in the freezing cold.
Check out the clothes, Abby said.
The album was bound in cracked brown leather and big enough that it took up both her lap and Daniel's. The photos, tucked into little paper corners, were spotted and browning at the edges.
I want this hat. I think I'm in love with this hat.
It was an architectural fringe thing, topping off a large lady with a monobosom and a fishy stare.
Isn't that the lampshade in the dining room? I said. I'll get it down for you if you promise to wear it to college tomorrow.
Good Lord, Justin said, perching on the other arm of the sofa and peering over Abby's shoulder. They all seem terribly depressed, don't they? You don't look a thing like any of them, Daniel.
Thank God for small mercies, Rafe said.
He was blowing on his hot port with his free arm draped across my back. He had apparently forgiven me for whatever it was that I, or Lexi, had done.
I've never seen such a goggle-eyed bunch. Maybe they all have thyroid problems and that's why they're depressed.
Actually, Daniel said, both the protruding eyes and the somber expressions are characteristic of photographs from that period. I wonder if it had anything to do with the long exposure time. The Victorian camera.
Rafe pretended to have a narcoleptic attack on my shoulder.
Justin produced a huge yawn, and Abby and I was only a second behind her, stuck our free hands over our ears and started singing.
All right, Daniel said, smiling.
I had never been this close to him before. He smelled good, cedar and clean wool.
I am just defending my ancestors. In any case, I think I do look like one of them.
Where is he?
This one. Here.
Going by the clothes, the photo had been taken somewhere around 100 years ago. The guy was younger than Daniel, 20 at most, and standing on the front steps of a younger, brighter Whitethorn house. No ivy on the walls, glossy new paint on the door and the railings. The stone steps sharp-edged and scrubbed pale. There was a resemblance there, all right. He had Daniel's square jaw and broad forehead, although his looked even broader because the dark hair was slicked back fiercely, and the same straight-cut mouth. But this guy was leaning against the railing with a lazy, dangerous ease that was nothing like Daniel's tidy, symmetrical poise, and his wide-set eyes had a different look to them, something restless and haunted.
Wow, I said.
The resemblance, that face passed across a century, was doing strange things to me. I would have envied Daniel, in some unreasonable way, if it hadn't been for Lexi.
You do look like him.
Only less messed up, Abby said. That's not a happy man.
But look at the house, Justin said softly. Isn't it beautiful?
It is. Yes, Daniel said, smiling down at it.
It really is.
We'll get there. Abby slipped a fingernail under the photo, flicked it out of its corners, and turned it over. On the back it said, in watery fountain pen, William, May 1914.
The First World War was coming up, I said quietly. Maybe he died in it.
Actually, Daniel said, taking the photo from Abby and examining it more closely. I don't think he did.
Good heavens.
If this is the same William, and it may not be, of course, my family has always been singularly unimaginative when it comes to names, then I've heard about him. My father and my aunts mentioned him every now and then when I was a child. He's my grandfather's uncle, I think, although I may have that wrong. William was, well, not a black sheep exactly, more like a skeleton in the cupboard.
Definitely a resemblance, Rafe said.
Then,
ow!
As Abby reached across and swatted his arm.
He did fight in the war, in fact, Daniel said. But he came back with some kind of infirmity. Nobody ever mentioned what exactly, which makes me think it may have been psychological rather than physical. There was some scandal. I'm hazy on the details. It was all kept very hush-hush, but he spent a while in some kind of sanatorium.
which at the time might well have been a delicate way of saying a lunatic asylum.
Maybe he had a passionate affair with Wilfred Owen, Justin suggested.
In the trenches? Rafe sighed noisily.
I got the impression it was more along the lines of a suicide attempt, said Daniel. When he got out, he emigrated, I think. He lived to a ripe old age. He only died when I was a child, but still not necessarily the ancestor one would choose to resemble.
You're right, Abby. Not a happy man.
He tucked the photo back into place and touched it gently with one long square fingertip before he turned the page. The hot port was rich and sweet, with quarters of lemon stuck full of cloves, and Daniel's arm was warm and solid against mine. He flipped pages slowly, mustaches the size of house pets, lacy Edwardians walking in the flowering herb garden.
My God, Abby said on a long breath. That's what it's supposed to look like.
Flappers with carefully droopy shoulders. A few people were built along the same lines as Daniel and William, tall and solid, with jawlines that worked better on the men than on the women. But most of them were small and upright, and made of mainly sharp angles, jutting chins and elbows and noses.
This thing is brilliant, I said. Where did you find it?
A sudden, startled silence.
Oh, God, I thought. Oh, God, not now. Not just when I was starting to feel like...
But you find it, Justin said, his glass going down on his knee.
In the top spare room, don't you?
He let the sentence drop. No one picked it up.
Never, Frank had told me. No matter what, never backpedal. If you fuck up, blame it on the coma, PMS, the full moon, anything you want. Just hold your ground.
No, I said. I'd remember if I'd seen this before. They were all looking at me. Daniel's eyes, only inches away, were intent and curious and huge behind his glasses. I knew I had gone white. He couldn't miss it.
He thought you'd never made it. He had some bizarro convoluted theory.
You did, Lexi, Abby said softly, leaning forward so she could see me. You and Justin were rummaging around after dinner, and you came up with this. It was the same night that... She made a small, formless gesture, glanced fast at Daniel.
It was just a few hours before the incident, said Daniel.
I thought I felt something move through his body, something like a tiny suppressed shudder, but I couldn't be sure. I was too busy trying to hide my own rush of pure relief.
No wonder you don't remember.
Well, Rafe said one notch too loudly and too heartily. There you go.
But that sucks, I said.
Now I feel like an idiot. I didn't mind losing the sore bits, but I don't want to go around wondering what else is missing. What if I bought the winning lotto ticket and hid it somewhere?
Shh, Daniel said. He was smiling at me. That extraordinary smile.
Don't worry. We forgot all about the album as well until tonight. We never even looked at it. He took my hand, opened my fingers gently. I hadn't even realized my fists were clenched, and drew it through the crook of his elbow.
I'm glad you found it. This house has enough history for a whole village. It shouldn't be lost.
Look at this one, the cherry trees, just planted.
And check him out, said Abby, pointing to a guy wearing full hunting gear and sitting on a rangy chestnut horse beside the front gate.
He'd have a Mickey fit if he knew we were keeping motoring cars in his stables.
Her voice sounded fine, easy, cheerful, not even a sliver of a pause, but her eyes, flicking to me across Daniel, were anxious.
If I'm not mistaken, Daniel said. That's our benefactor.
He flipped out the photo and checked the back.
Yes, Simon on Highwayman,
November 1949. He would have been 21 or so. Uncle Simon was from the main branch of the family tree, short and wiry, with an arrogant nose and a fierce look. "Another unhappy man," Daniel said. His wife died young, and apparently he never really recovered. That's when he began drinking. As Justin said, not a cheerful bunch. He started to fit the photo back into its corners, but Abby said, "No," and took it out of his hand. She passed her glass to Daniel, went to the fireplace and propped the picture in the middle of the mantelpiece. "There."
"Why?"
Rafe inquired.
"Because," Abby said, "we owe him.
He could have left this place to the Equine Society, and I'd be still living in a scary basement bedsit with no windows and hoping that the nut bar upstairs wouldn't decide to break in some night. And as far as I'm concerned, this guy deserves a place of honor."
"Oh, Abby, sweetie," Justin said, holding out an arm. "Come here."
Abby adjusted a candlestick to hold the photo in place. "There," she said, and went to Justin. He fitted his arm around her and pulled her against him, her back leaning against his chest. She took back her glass from Daniel. "Here's to Uncle Simon," she said. Uncle Simon gave us all a baleful, unimpressed glare.
"Why not?" Rafe said, raising his glass high. "Uncle Simon."
The port, glowing deep and strong as blood, Daniel's arm and Rafe's holding me snug in place between them. A gust of wind rattling the windows and swaying the cobwebs in the high corners.
"To Uncle Simon," we said.
All of us. Later in my room, I sat on the windowsill and went through my various new bits of information. All four of the housemates had deliberately hidden how upset they were and hidden it well. Abby threw kitchen utensils when she got angry enough. Rafe, at least, somehow blamed Lexi for getting stabbed. Justin had been sure they were going to be arrested. Daniel hadn't fallen for the coma story. And Rafe had heard Lexi telling him she was coming home the day before I said yes. Here's one of the more disturbing things about work and murder. How little you think about the person who's been killed. There are some who move into your mind. Children, battered pensioners, girls who went clubbing in their sparkly, hopeful best and ended the night in bog drains. But mostly, the victim is only your starting point. The gold at the end of the rainbow is the killer. It's scarily easy to slip to the point where the victim becomes incidental, half forgotten for days on end, just a prop wheeled out for the prologue so that the real show can start. Rob and I used to stick a photo smack in the middle of the whiteboard on every case. Not a crime scene shot or a posed portrait. A snapshot, the candidest candid we could find. A bright snippet from the time when this person was something more than a murder victim. To keep us reminded. This isn't just callousness or self-preservation. The cold fact is that every murder I've worked was about the killer, the victim. And imagine explaining this to families who have nothing left but the hope of a reason. The victim was just the person who happened to wander into the sights when the gun was loaded and cocked. The control freak was always going to kill his wife the first time she refused to follow orders. Your daughter happened to be the one who married him. The mugger was hanging around the alleyway with a knife, and your husband happened to be the next person who walked by. We go through victims' lives with a fine-tooth comb, but we're doing it to learn more not about them, but about the murderer. If we can figure out the exact point where someone walked into those crosshairs, we can go to work with our dark, stained geometries and draw a line straight back to the barrel of the gun. The victim can tell us how, but almost never why. The only reason, the beginning and the end, the closed circle, is the killer. This case had been different from the first moment. I had never been in any danger of forgetting about Lexi, and not just because I carried the reminder photo around with me,
there every time I brushed my teeth or washed my hands. From the second I walked into that cottage, before I ever saw her face, this had been about her. For the first time ever, the murderer was the one I kept forgetting. The possibility hit me like a wrecking ball. Suicide? I felt like I had fallen off the windowsill, straight through the glass and down into cold air. If this killer had never been anything but invisible, if Lexi had been the core of the case all along, maybe it was because there had never been a killer at all. She was all there was. In that split second, I saw it as clearly as if it were unfolding on the dark lawn below me, in all its slow, sickening horror. The others, putting away the cards and stretching. Where's Lexi got to? And then the worry winding tighter and tighter, till finally they put on coats and went out into the night to look for her. Torches, rain gusting hard. Lexi! Lex! The four of them crammed in the wrecked cottage, gasping for breath, shaking hands, feeling for a pulse, pressing harder, moving her into shelter and laying her out so gently, reaching for the knife, fumbling in her pockets for some note, some explanation, some word. Maybe, Jesus, maybe they had even found one. A moment later, of course, my head cleared. My breath came back, and I knew that was rubbish. It would explain a lot. Rafe's snit fit, Daniel's suspicions, Justin's nerves, the moved body, the searched pockets. And we've all heard about cases where people staged everything from improbable accidents through murders, rather than let their loved ones be branded as suicides. But I couldn't think of a single reason why they would have left her there all night for someone else to find. And anyway, women generally don't commit suicide by knifing themselves in the chest. And above all that, there was the immovable fact that Lexi, even if whatever went down in March had somehow wrecked all this for her, this house, these friends, this life, was about the last person in the world who would have killed herself. Suicides are people who can't see any other way out. From what we had learned, Lexi had had no trouble finding escape routes when she wanted them. Downstairs, Abby was humming to herself. Justin sneezed, a chain of small, fastidious yelps. Someone slammed a drawer. I was in bed and halfway asleep when I realized. I had forgotten all about ringing Sam. Chapter 8. God, that first week. Even thinking about it, I want to bite into it like the world's brightest red apple. In the middle of an all-out murder investigation, while Sam worked his way painstakingly through various shades of scumbag, and Frank tried to explain our situation to the FBI without coming across like a lunatic, there was nothing I was supposed to be doing except living Lexi's life. It gave me a gleeful, lazy, daring feeling right down to my toes, like mitching off school when it's the best day of spring and you know your class has to dissect frogs. On Tuesday, I went back to college. In spite of the vast number of new opportunities to fuck up, I was looking forward to it. I loved Trinity the first time round. It still has its centuries of graceful grey stone, red brick, cobblestones. You can feel the layers on layers of lost students streaming through Front Square beside you. Feel the print of you being added to the air, archived, saved. If someone hadn't decided to drive me out of college, I might have turned into an internal student like these four. Instead, and probably because of that same person, I turned into a cop. I liked the thought that this had brought me full circle, back to reclaim the place I'd lost. It felt like a strange delayed victory, something salvaged against ridiculous odds. "You should probably know," Abby said in the car. "The rumor mill's been going mental. Apparently it was a major coke deal gone wrong, also an illegal immigrant. You married him for money and then started blackmailing him. Also, an abusive ex-boyfriend who just got out of jail for beating you up. Brace yourself.
Also, I assume, Daniel said, maneuvering past an explorer that was blocking two lanes. All of us, singly, or in various combinations and for various motives. No one said so to our faces, of course, but the inference is inevitable.
He swung into the entrance of the Trinity car park and held up his ID for the security guard.
If people ask questions, what are you going to tell them?
I haven't decided yet, I said. I was thinking about saying I'm the last heir to some throne and a rival faction came after me, but I couldn't decide which throne. Do I look like a Romanov?
Definitely, said Rafe. They were a bunch of chinless weirdos. Go for that.
Be nice to me, or I'll tell everyone you came after me with a cleaver in a drug-fueled rage.
It's not funny, said Justin. He hadn't brought his car. I got the sense they all wanted to stick close together just now. So he was in the back with me and Rafe, rubbing flecks of dirt off the windowpane and wiping his fingers on his handkerchief.
Well, said Abby, it wasn't funny last week, no. But now that you're back...
She turned to grin at me over her shoulder.
Four boobs Brenda asked me, you know that horrible confidential whisper, if it was one of those games gone wrong. I just froze her out, but now I'm thinking I could have made her day.
What amazes me about her, Daniel said, opening his door, is that she's so determined to believe we're wildly interesting. If only she knew.
When we got out of the car, I got my first real look at what Frank had meant about these four, how they came across to outsiders. As we walked down the long avenue between the sports fields, something happened. A change as subtle and definite as water turning to ice. They moved closer, shoulder to shoulder and in step, backs straightening, heads lifting, expressions falling away from their faces. By the time we reached the arts block, the facade was in place, a barricade so impenetrable you could almost see it, cool and glinting like diamond. All that week in college, every time someone started angling for a good stare at me, edging down the library shelves towards the corner where we had our carols, rubbernecking round a newspaper in the tea queue. That barricade swung around like a Roman shield formation, confronting the intruder with four pairs of impassive, unblinking eyes, till he or she backed off. Collecting gossip was going to be a major problem. Even Four Boobs Brenda stopped mid-breath, hovering over my desk, and then asked if she could borrow a pen. Lexi's thesis turned out to be a lot more fun than I'd thought. The bits Frank had given me were mainly stuff about the Brontes. Currer Bell is the mad woman in the attic bursting free from demure Charlotte. Truth in Alias. Not exactly comfortable reading, in the circumstances, but more or less what you'd expect. What she'd been working on just before she died was a lot snazzier. Rip Corelli, of She Dressed to Kill fame. Turned out to be Bernice Matlock, a librarian from Ohio who had led a blameless life and written lurid pulp masterpieces in her spare time. I was starting to like the way Lexi's mind had worked. I'd been worried that her supervisor would want me to come up with something that made academic sense. Lexi had been no idiot. Her stuff was smart and original and well thought out, and I was years out of practice. I'd been worried about her supervisor all round, actually. Her tutorial students weren't going to spot the difference. When you're 18, most people over 25 are just generic adult white noise. But someone who'd spent one-on-one time with her was a whole different story. One meeting with him reassured me. He was a bony, gentle, disconnected guy who was so paralyzed by the whole unfortunate incident that he could barely look me in the eye, and he told me to take all the recovery time I needed and not to worry about deadlines. I figured I could handle a few weeks curled up in the library reading about hard-boiled PIs and dames who were nothing but trouble. And in the evenings, there was the house. We put some work into it almost every day, Maybe for an hour or two, maybe just for 20 minutes. Sand down the stairs, sort through a box from Uncle Simon's stash, take turns climbing the stepladder to change the ancient brittle fittings on the light bulbs. The crappiest jobs, scrubbing stains off the toilets, got the same time and care as the interesting ones. The four of them treated the house like some marvelous musical instrument, a Stradivarius or Bösendorfer, that they had found in a long-lost treasure trove and were restoring with patient, enchanted, absolute love. I think the most relaxed I ever saw Daniel was flat on his stomach on the kitchen floor, wearing battered old trousers and a plaid shirt, painting baseboards and laughing at some story Rafe was telling, while Abby leaned over him to dip her brush, her ponytail whisking paint across his cheek. They were very tactile, all of them. We never touched in college, but at home, someone was always touching someone. Daniel's hand on Abby's head as he passed behind her chair, Rafe's arm on Justin's shoulder as they examined some spare room discovery together. Abby lying back in the swing seat across my lap and Justin's. Rafe's ankles crossed over mine as we read by the fire. Frank made predictable snide noises about homosexuality and orgies, but I was on full alert for any kind of sexual vibe, the baby. And that wasn't what I was picking up. It was stranger and more powerful than that. They didn't have boundaries. Not among themselves, not the way most people do. Your average house share involves a pretty high level of territorial dispute. Tense negotiations over the remote control, house meetings about whether bread counts as personal or shared. Rob's flatmate used to have a 3-day snit fit if he used her butter. But these people, as far as I could tell, everything, except, thank God, underwear, belonged to all of them. The guys pulled clothes out of the airing cupboard at random, anything that would fit. I never did figure out which tops were officially Lexi's and which ones were Abby's. They ripped sheets of paper out of each other's notepads, ate toast off the nearest plate, took sips out of whatever glass was handy. I didn't mention this to Frank. He would only have switched from orgy comments to dark warnings about communism. And I liked the blurred boundaries. They reminded me of something warm and solid that I couldn't quite pinpoint. There was a big green wax jacket hanging in the coat closet left over from Uncle Simon that belonged to anyone who was going out in the rain. The first time I put it on for my walk, it gave me a strange, intoxicating little thrill, like holding hands with a boy for the very first time. It was Thursday when I managed to put my finger on the feeling. The days were starting to lengthen towards summer, and it was a clear, warm, graceful evening. After dinner, we took a bottle of wine and a plate of sponge cake out onto the lawn. I had made a daisy chain and was trying to fasten it around my wrist. By this time, I had given up on the not drinking thing. It felt out of character. It made the others think about the stabbing and tense up. And besides, whatever antibiotics and booze do together could get me out of there when I needed it. So I was mildly, happily tipsy. "More cake," Rafe demanded, nudging me with his foot. "Get it yourself, I'm busy." I had given up on fastening the daisy chain one-handed and was putting it on Justin instead. "You're a lazy object, do you know that?" "Look who's talking." I pulled one of my ankles around the back of my head. All the gymnastics as a kid, I'm flexible. And stuck my tongue out at Rafe from under my knee. "I'm active and healthy, look." Rafe raised one eyebrow lazily. "I'm aroused." "You're a pervert," I told him, with as much dignity as I could from that position. "Knock it off," Abby said. "You'll burst your stitches and we're all too drunk to drive you to the emergency room." I'd forgotten all about my imaginary stitches. For a second, I considered getting wound up about this. But I decided against it. The long evening sunshine and being barefoot and the tickle of grass and presumably the booze were making me light-headed and silly. It had been a long time since I'd felt like this, and I liked it. I maneuvered my head round to peer sideways at Abby. They're fine. They're not even sore anymore.
That's because up until now you haven't been tying yourself in knots, Daniel said. Behave.
Normally I'm allergic to bossy, but somehow this felt nice, cozy.
Yes, Dad,
I said, and disentangled my leg, which sent me off balance so I fell over onto Justin.
Ow! Get off me,
he said, flapping a hand at me without much energy.
God, how much do you weigh?
I wriggled myself comfortable and stayed put with my head in his lap, squinting up into the sunset. He tickled my nose with a grass stem. I looked relaxed. At least, I hoped I did. But my mind was going fast. I had just realized. Yes, Dad. What this whole setup reminded me of. A family. Maybe not a real-life family, although what would I know? But a family out of a million children's book series and old TV shows, the comforting kind that go on for years without anyone getting older, to the point where you start to wonder about the actor's hormone levels. These five had it all. Daniel, the distant but affectionate father. Justin and Abby taking turns to be the protective mammy and the lofty eldest. Rafe, the moody teenage middle kid, and Lexi, the late arrival, the capricious little sister to be alternately spoiled and teased. They probably had no more clue about real-life families than I did. I should have spotted from the beginning that this was one of the things they had in common. Daniel, orphaned. Abby, fostered out. Justin and Rafe, exiled. Lexi, God knows what, but not exactly close to her parents. I'd skimmed over it because it was my default mode too. Consciously or subconsciously, they had collected every paper-thin scrap they could find and built their own patchwork makeshift image of what a family was, and then they had made themselves into that. The four of them had been only 18 or so when they had met. I looked at them under my lashes, Daniel holding a bottle up to the light to see if there was any wine left. Abby flicking ants off the cake plate, and wondered what they would have been if they'd missed each other along the way. This gave me a whole bunch of ideas, but they were hazy and fast-moving, and I decided I was too comfortable to try and put any shape on them. They could wait a few hours, till my walk. Me too, I said to Daniel, and held out my glass for more wine.
Are you drunk?
Frank demanded when I rang him.
You sounded langered earlier.
Relax, Frankie, I said. I had a couple of glasses of wine with dinner. That doesn't make me drunk.
It better not. This may feel like a holiday, but I don't want you treating it like one. You stay alert.
I was loitering along a potholy lane uphill from the ruined cottage. I had been thinking a lot about how Lexi had ended up in that cottage. We had all taken it for granted that she was running for cover and couldn't make Whitethorn House of the village, either because the killer was blocking her way or because she was fading fast. So she made for the nearest hiding place she knew. N changed that. Assuming N was a person, as opposed to a pub or a radio program or a poker game. They had had to meet somewhere. And the fact that no places were marked in the diary said they had used the same meeting point every time. And if those times were nights rather than mornings, then the cottage made total sense. Privacy, convenience, shelter from wind and rain, and no way for anyone to sneak up on you. She could have been heading there anyway that night, long before someone jumped her, and just kept going, maybe on autopilot. After N ambushed her on her way. Maybe because she hoped N would be there to help her. It wasn't the kind of lead detectives dream of, but it was about the best I'd got. So I was spending a lot of my walk lurking in the general area of the cottage and hoping N would help me out by showing up some night. I had found myself a convenient stretch of lane. It had a clear enough view that I could keep an eye on the cottage while I talked to Frank or Sam, enough trees to hide me if I needed it, and enough isolation that no farmer was likely to hear me on the phone and come after me with his trusty shotgun. "I'm alert," I said, "and I've got something to ask you. Remind me, Daniel's great-uncle died in September?" I heard Frank moving stuff around, flipping pages. Either he had brought the file home with him, or he was still at work.
"February 3rd. Daniel got the keys to the house on September 10th. Probate must have taken a while. Why?"
"Can you find out how the great-uncle died and where these five were that day? Also, why probate took so long? When my granny left me a grand, I got it 6 weeks later."
Frank whistled. "You're thinking they bumped off great-uncle Simon for the house, and then Lexi lost her nerve?"
I sighed and ran a hand through my hair, trying to work out how to explain. "Not exactly. Actually, not at all. But they're weird about that house, Frank. All four of them. They all talk about it like they own it, not just Daniel. We should get double glazing. We need to decide about the herb garden. We..." And they all act like this is a permanent arrangement. Like they can spend years doing it up because they're all going to live here forever.
"Ah, they're just young," Frank said tolerantly.
"At that age, everyone thinks college mates and house shares are forever. Give them a few years and it'll be all semi-dees in the suburbs and Sunday afternoons buying decking at the home and garden shop."
"They're not that young. And you've heard them. They're way too wrapped up in this house and each other. There's nothing else in their lives. I don't really think they knocked off the great uncle, but I'm shooting in the dark here. We've always thought they were hiding something. Anything weird is worth checking out."
"True," Frank said.
"Will do. Don't you want to hear what I've been doing with my day?"
That undercurrent of excitement in his voice. Very few things get Frank that worked up.
"Damn straight," I said.
The undercurrent broke through into a grin so wide I could hear it.
"FBI got a hit on our girl's prince."
"Shit, already?" The FBI guys are good about helping us when we need it, but they always have a spectacular backlog.
"I've got friends in low places."
"Okay," I said. "Who is she?" For some reason, my knees felt shaky. I got my back up against a tree.
"May Ruth Thibodeau, born in North Carolina in 1975, reported missing in October 2000 and wanted for car theft. Prints and photo both match."
My breath went out with a little rush.
"Cassie,"
Frank said after a moment. I heard him draw on a cigarette.
"You still there?"
"Yeah." "May Ruth Thibodeau." Saying it made my back prickle. "What do we know about her?"
"Not a lot. No info till 1997, when she moved to Raleigh from someplace in the arsehole of nowhere. Rented a fleabag apartment in a crap neighborhood and got a job waiting tables in an all-night diner. She had an education somewhere along the way, if she was able to jump straight into a postgrad at Trinity. But it's looking like self-taught or homeschooled. She doesn't show up on the register at any local college or high school. No criminal record."
Frank blew out smoke.
"On the evening of October 10th, 2000, she borrowed her fiancé's car to get to work, but she never showed up. He filed a missing person report a couple of days later. The cops didn't take it too seriously. They figured she'd just taken off. They gave the fiancé a little hassle, just in case he had killed her and dumped her somewhere. But his alibi was good. The car turned up in New York in December 2000 at long-term parking at Kennedy Airport."
He was very pleased with himself.
"Nice one, Frank," I said automatically. "Fair play to you."
"We aim to please,"
Frank said, trying to sound modest. She was only a year younger than me after all. I was playing marbles in soft rain in a Wicklow garden, and she was running wild in some hot small town, barefoot at the soda fountain and jolting down dirt roads in the back of a pickup truck, till one day she got in a car and she just kept driving.
Cassie?
Yeah?
My contact's going to do some more digging, see if she made any serious enemies along the way. Anyone who might have tracked her here.
Sounds good, I said, trying to pull my head together. That sounds like the kind of thing I might want to know. What was the fiancé's name?
Brad, Chad, Chet, one of those American yokes.
Papers rustling.
My boy made a couple of phone calls and the guy hasn't missed a day of work in months. No way he hopped across the pond to kill off the ex. Chad, Andrew Mitchell. Why?
No N.
I just wondered.
Frank waited. But I'm good at that game.
Fair enough, he said, finally. I'll keep you posted. The ID might take us nowhere, but still, it's nice to have some kind of handle on this girl. Makes it easier to get your head round the idea of her, no?
Oh yeah, I said. Definitely. It wasn't true. After Frank hung up, I spent a long time leaning against that tree, watching the broken outline of the cottage slowly fade and reappear as clouds moved across the moon, thinking about May Ruth Thibodeau. Somehow, giving her back her own name, her own hometown, her own story, brought it home to me. She had been real, not just the shadow cast by my mind and Frank's. She had been alive. There had been 30 years in which we could have come face to face. It seemed to me suddenly that I should have known an ocean away, but it seemed like I should have felt her there all along, like every now and then I should have looked up from my marbles or my textbook or my case report as if someone had called my name. She came all those thousands of miles, close enough to slip on my old name like a sister's hand-me-down coat. She came pulled like a compass needle, and she almost made it. She was only an hour's drive away. And I should have known. I should have known in time to take that last step and find her. The only shadows over that week came from outside. We were playing poker, Friday evening. They played cards a lot, late into the nights, mostly Texas Hold'em or 110, sometimes piquet, if only two people felt like playing. The stakes were just tarnished 10-pence pieces from a huge jar someone had found in the attic. But they took it seriously all the same. Everyone started with the same number of coins, and when you were out, you were out. No borrowing from the stash. Lexi, like me, had been a pretty decent card player. Her calls hadn't always made a lot of sense, but apparently she had learned to make the unpredictability work for her, especially on big hands. The winner got to choose the next day's dinner menu. That night we had Louis Armstrong on the record player, and Daniel had bought a huge bag of Doritos along with three different dips to keep everyone happy. We were maneuvering around the various chipped bowls and using the food to try and distract each other. It worked best on Justin, who lost his concentration completely if he thought you were about to get salsa on the mahogany. I had just wiped out Rafe head to head. On weak hands, he messed around with the dips. If he had something good, he shoveled Doritos straight into his mouth by the handful. Never play poker with a detective. And I was busy gloating when his phone rang. He tilted his chair backwards and grabbed the phone off one of the bookshelves. Hello, he said, giving me the finger. Then his chair came down and his face changed. It froze over into that haughty, unreadable mask he wore in college and around outsiders. Dad, he said. Without an eye blink, the others drew closer around him. You could feel it in the air, a tightening, a solidifying as they ranged themselves at his shoulders. I was next to him, and I got the full benefit of the bellow coming out of the phone.
Job opened up, foot on the ladder. Changed your mind.
Rafe's nostrils twitched as if he had smelled something foul.
Not interested, he said.
The volume of the tirade made his eyes snap shut. I caught enough of it to gather that reading plays all day was for pansies,
and that someone called Bradbury had a son who had just made his first million, and that Rafe was generally a waste of oxygen. He held the phone between thumb and finger, inches from his ear.
"For God's sake, hang up,"
Justin whispered. His face was pulled into an unconscious, agonized grimace.
"Just hang up on him."
"He can't," Daniel said softly. "He should, obviously, but someday." Abby shrugged. "Well then," she said. She sent the cards arcing from hand to hand with a fast, sassy flourish and dealt five hands. Daniel smiled across at her and pulled his chair up, ready. The phone was still going strong. The word arse came up regularly, in what sounded like a wide variety of contexts. Rafe's chin was tucked in like he was braced against gale force wind. Justin touched his arm. His eyes flew open and he stared at us, reddening right up to his hairline. The rest of us had already thrown in our stakes. I had a hand like a foot, a 7 and a 9, not even suited. But I knew exactly what the others were doing. They were pulling Rafe back, and the thought of being part of that sent something intoxicating through me. Something so fine it hurt. For a split second, I thought of Rob hooking one foot around my ankle, under our desks, when O'Kelly was giving me a bollocking. I waved my cards at Rafe and mouthed, "Ante up!" He blinked. I cocked one eyebrow, gave him my best cheeky Lexi grin, and whispered, "Unless you're scared, I'll kick your ass again." The frozen look dissolved, just a little. He checked his cards, then he put the phone down on the bookshelf beside him, carefully, and tossed 10 pence into the middle.
"Because I'm happy where I am,"
he told the phone. His voice sounded almost normal, but that angry red flush was still covering his face. Abby gave him a tiny smile, fanned 3 cards deftly on the table and flipped them over.
"Lexi's drawing 2 as straight, said Justin, narrowing his eyes at me. "I know that look."
The phone had apparently spent a lot of money on Rafe and wasn't planning to see it flushed down the bog.
"She's not," Daniel said. "She may have something, but not the makings of a straight."
"I call."
I was nowhere near a straight, but that wasn't the point. None of us were folding. Not till Rafe hung up.
The phone made a big statement about a real job.
"In other words, a job in an office," Rafe informed us. The rigidity was starting to go out of his spine. "Maybe even someday if I'm a team player and I think outside the box and work smarter, not harder, an office with a window. Or am I aiming a little high?" he asked the phone. "What do you think?" he mined. "See your 1 and raise you 2 at Justin.
The phone, it obviously knew it was being insulted, even if it wasn't sure exactly how, said something belligerent about ambition and how it was about bloody time Rafe grew up and started living in the real world.
"Ah," Daniel said, glancing up from his stack. "Now that's a concept that's always fascinated me. The real world. Only a very specific subset of people use the term. Have you noticed? To me, it seems self-evident that everyone lives in the real world. We all breathe real oxygen, eat real food. The earth under our feet feels equally solid to all of us. But clearly these people have a far more tightly circumscribed definition of reality. One that I find deeply mysterious, and an almost pathologically intense need to bring others into line with that definition."
"It's all jealousy," Justin said, considering his cards and flipping 2 more coins into the middle. "Sour grapes."
"Nobody,"
Rafe told the phone, flapping a hand at us to keep our voices down.
"The television. I spend my days watching soap operas, eating bonbons and plotting society's downfall."
The last card came up a 9, which at least gave me a pair.
"Well,
Certainly in some cases jealousy is a factor, Daniel said. But Rafe's father, if half what he says is true, could afford to live any life he wanted, including ours. What does he have to be jealous of?